Thank you, Robert. You're a nice guy. Chapter 11. Now I have a question. Is this loud? Who said yes? My daughter, I trust you. If it was Joseph, I don't trust him. Frenchie, it's a little bit loud. Seemed loud. And if I get loud, it'll be really loud. 1 Samuel chapter 11. As we begin reading, I will tell you ahead of time the nice news. If you're a fan of Saul, this is the only chapter you have in the book of 1 Samuel that's good. This is the good chapter. It is a very good chapter. There's only one question mark that honestly I never saw till this week, and I didn't see it. Somebody else saw it. But on the whole, this is a very good chapter. And as I have in your notes, it really deals with leadership. It's Saul the leader. It's really going to answer a question way back in chapter 8 when the people come to Samuel and they say, hey, we want a king that can go out and fight our battles like other nations have. And they have finally got that king, at least it appears in chapter 11. And we'll read this totally in a positive way. We don't need to read back because, by the way, it's it. Chapter 12, it's all downhill after that. Nothing good about Saul the rest of the book, unless you think having his head hanged in the temple of Dagon is a good thing. Chapter 11. However you say this poor guy's name, in Hebrew it would be something like Nahash. It could be Nahash, whatever. The Ammonite came up and encamped against Jabesh-Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said unto Nahash, make a covenant with us and we will serve thee. By the way, you still know things are very, very bad and there's not a unified country. When you got parts of your country happening to make an alliance with pagan peoples, you know things aren't good. Now remember, it was Ammon, Moab, Edom. So the Ammonites were in the north. These are the people that lived on the other side of Jordan. So, you know, things aren't good. Verse 2. And Nahash the Ammonite answered them, on this condition will I make a covenant with you, that I may thrust out your right eyes and lay it for a reproach upon all of Israel. And the elders of Jabesh said unto him, give us 7 days respite that we may send messengers into all the coast of Israel. And then if there be no man to save us, we will come out to thee. Can you imagine you're going to come out and they're going to put your eye out? Then came the messengers to Gibeah of Saul and told the tidings in the ears of the people, and all the people lifted up their voices and wept. I only did not spend the time, and I will this next week, on that little phrase, Gibeah of Saul. That is found two other times in 1 Samuel. And if you remember, Gibeah was the city in Judges 19 where the man goes into and they rape his concubine all night. And because of that event, God nearly destroys the Benjamites. So the first king is a what group? A Benjamite from Gibeah. But that never bothered you before, did it? Because he's a good godly. I heard John O'Reilly saying how godly he was, and I'm like, have you ever read the story? But see, when you go to the New Testament and think that way and go back in the Old Testament, you're looking for all the wrong things. You ought to be looking where people are from, what people are known as, you know, like Samuel. Saul, is Saul among the prophets? We continue. Verse 5, and behold, Saul came after the herd out of the field, and Saul said, what aileth the people that they weep? And they told him the tidings of the men of Jabesh. And the Spirit of God came upon Saul when he had heard those tidings, and his anger was kindled greatly. And he took a yoke of oxen and hewed them in pieces and sent them throughout all the coast of Israel by the hands of the messenger, saying, whosoever cometh not after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done unto his oxen. And the fear of the Lord fell on the people. Excuse me. And they came out with one consent. And when he had numbered them in Bezek, the children of Israel were 300,000 and the men of Judah 30,000. And they said unto the messengers that came, thus shall you say unto the men of Jabesh-Gilead, tomorrow by that time the sun be hot, ye shall have help. And the messengers came and showed it to the men of Jabesh, and they were glad. Therefore the men of Jabesh said, tomorrow we will come out unto you, and you shall do with us all that seemeth good unto thee. It's almost like they talked to the Ammonites to try to trick them a little bit. We're coming out, we're going to surrender. And it was so on the morning that Saul put the people in three companies, and they came into the midst of the host in the morning watch, 2 to 6 a.m. about. And they slew the Ammonites until the heat of the day, and it came to pass that they which remained were scattered, so that two of them were not left together. And the people said unto Samuel, who is he that said, shall Saul reign over us? Bring the men that we may put them to death. And Saul said, there shall not a man be put to death this day. For today the Lord hath wrought salvation in Israel. Then said Samuel to the people, come and let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there. And all the people went on to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. And there they sacrifices of peace offerings before the Lord, and there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. We're going to look tonight at Saul the leader. I'm going to pray, and I'm going to say this afterwards. As a pastor, I have come to realize all of my frustrations come down to two. And they're related. And if this offends you, it's not meant to offend you, but it becomes obvious. When I say something that's life or death, men do something. And some people go back to sleep. What I have come to realize, that's a matter of leadership. We're going to be talking about leadership, but none of us are going to be the king of Israel. We're going to talk about leadership in your home, at your job. You show me a man or a woman, when something comes up, look at me in the eyes, when something comes up, a man stands immediately, and a weenie goes back to watching television. I've been here 20 years, and I've seen it over and over in families. I think of a lieutenant commander in this church that's no longer here, and I think of a guy named Cliff Cavallis. One was a weenie, I don't care what his rank was, and one was a man. And something happened in this guy's family, the world is going to end. Something happens in this guy's family, he goes back to sleep. Are you a leader? If you're alive, God has put you in areas of leadership. Yes. So the old blue collar, put your feet up, it's not my job, doesn't really work. And I'm going to say this, I'm not trying to be mean to anybody. God makes us differently. I'm a big mouth bulldog. You get in my road on something, you're getting run over. I already know that. But here's the problem. God's called you to lead in some areas too. Hello? And these aren't options. We'll talk about that as we look forward on leadership really tonight. Father, thank you for this great text. It is the one time we see some real good in Saul. We see lots of good in Saul in this text. We see a man that, and we think afterwards, what could have been? He could have been a great king. He could have ended up differently, at least humanly speaking. Help us tonight to learn some things about the leadership and how the Holy Spirit interacts with that leadership in our lives. We ask this now in Christ's name. Amen. His daughter was struggling. She was struggling everywhere. Life, school, church, with Christianity. Things had finally come to a head, a crisis. She was in big trouble. Was it alcohol? Was it drugs? Was it sex? Was it language? Was it rebellion? Was it suicidal thoughts? In this young lady's case, I think it was most of those. I'm not sure about the suicide. That day, and by the way, the story I'm telling, I'm the only one that knows the story because people have been gone so long, most of you wouldn't know they were here. It happened my first year here, and when it came to the crisis moment, I began to understand the difference between a follower and a leader. A follower puts his feet up and goes back to sleep, and a leader does something. His solution to his daughter's catastrophe was take her out of school, take her out of church, and go some other place. The problem is it's been 2 decades now. How's that been working out? As I learned then in 1996-7, I was to learn much more, but I was to learn at that juncture in this one fundamental lesson. All of us are leaders at some level. 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 I see men in this room that would rather sleep than confront anybody. What kind of a man are you? If my daughter and son-in-law or my son and daughter-in-law decide to be stupid, I may have no direct control, but I got news for you. They're going to be confronted. Most of us, we just put our feet back up on the cushion and get back to TV. All of us are leaders at some level. In our homes, in our own individual life, at work, in our broader family, meaning not just our immediate family, but in levels, in a Sunday school class, in Awana, in church, in the community, with our friends, all of us are leaders. Life requires leadership. Someone must lead. Someone will lead. Tragically, if a father will not lead, normally someone will, and it won't be the mother. It'll usually be one of the kids. Whoever the dad doesn't have enough character to confront, that individual runs the family, and everybody else goes back to sleep. By the way, you're not going to be comfortable tonight because this is a message on leadership. And I want to say this, from back here to Josh, up here to Josh, over here to my friend Cabazone, to the halls, we all have elements and areas of leadership. Maybe you're not the boss where you work. Maybe you're not the pastor of a church, but somebody's got to lead. It's always the person that's the strongest or the person that stands. I learned early on there are fathers that will not confront their children. That's inconceivable to me. Really? In your notes, 1 Samuel 3:11 deals with leadership and with Saul at his best. It all comes down to these verses. Way back in 1 Samuel 8, when they came to him and says, "Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." In verse 20, after some conversation, it says that we may also be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. I mean, everything comes to this. Is Saul going to be able to lead? Chapter 10 and verse 6. "And the Spirit of the Lord will come upon thee, and thou shalt prophesy with them, and shall be turned into another man." Verse 7. "And let it be, when these signs come upon thee, that thou do as occasion serve thee, for God is with thee." Meaning he was supposed to then take the reins of leadership. Of course, in chapter 10, verse 27, there was a group of men, which will be the end of this sermon, that said, "How shall this man save us?" You know, they were children of Belial, otherwise they were worthless people. And they despised him and brought him no presents, but he held his peace. What do we know about a leadership? Number one, a leader rises to the occasion. A leader rises to the occasion. Always, always, always. Everyone look at me. I told this story, but I haven't told it in probably 10 years. I wish I'd have taped it. It was from my least favorite professor at Covenant Seminary. He was the only professor I didn't like, and he didn't like me. He was an old Christian Reformed geezer, and they think Baptists and dispensationalists probably aren't saved, and I'm both of those. But he had a testimony. He was in his 80s when he taught us. And in the 1930s, during the height of the Great Depression, I've told this story before, he was going to a public school in the 1930s. He was a young boy. I think he said fifth grade. I could be wrong. It's been so many years since I heard this story. He was in fifth grade, I believe. He said, "We got a new teacher that year." And at 80 years old, and guys, don't look at me stupid, I had a woman teacher I was in love with when I was, a sophomore. I love that woman. I don't know why. He was in love with his fifth grade teacher. By the way, Brian used to be in love with Amy until she got married. I think he's given that dream up, I think. Christy, has he given that up? Anyhow, here's the story. One Monday, the teacher started teaching evolution. This is in the 1930s. Gave him a book on evolution. He was in love with it. He said in the classroom, I can still smell her perfume. It's 50 years later at the time. He says, I read that book in fifth grade. The next week, we were having family prayer around the table. And he says, right in the middle of the family prayer, I just told my dad, Dad, you're a liar. Now, by the way, there are men in this room, if you call them a liar, that wouldn't bother them. If you call my father a liar, you're in a fight right now. His word meant something. To liars, your word don't mean anything. He said, when I called my dad a liar, he had false teeth. He says those teeth almost came out. His dad, he said all he could do when I watched my dad, he could just barely restrain himself. What do you mean? And he told his dad the story of this teacher teaching him evolution. His dad said, can I see that book? He showed him that book. He met that teacher later and said, is this true? Is this what you're teaching? You look me in the eyes. Here's the difference between men in this males in this room and men. His father, when he found out this was true, moved his family across the country in the Great Depression, left a real job, and worked digging ditches for the next 5 to 10 years because his son would not learn evolution by a woman like that. And he put his son in a Christian school. That's what men do. Males never rise to the occasion. Look at me. I could bring Jim up here. He's nicer than me. He counsels people in his church, and this is what you find, Jim. You're counseling one right now. No matter what you say to him, he ain't never going to do it because he never rises to the occasion. He goes back to sleep. Always. It's TV, food, and sleep. That's his life. By the way, what do you mean rises to the occasion? I don't need to read the passage. You've read the passage, haven't you? They come and he finds out what? They want your city to surrender? They want to put out your right eye? And what do you do? I don't always rise to the occasion properly. I came as close as being angry. I'm not angry, by the way, folks. Some of you think I am. I came as close to being angry Tuesday night as you have ever seen me, and it's only by the grace of God and I'm getting old that I didn't choke several people. And you know what I'm talking about. I don't deal with foolishness very well. In your notes, as the old saying goes, when the going gets tough, the tough get going, and things couldn't be tougher. A city was under siege. A city willing to capitulate. They even said, hey, if we can't find someone to save us, we know we can't do it, so we'll capitulate to you. I say in your notes, and this is possibly, I should have, and I will do that in your notes, Christy, it possibly is the key. This is possibly part of a larger campaign. Frenchie asked me what this meant. I say in your notes, this expansion from the Bible is found in a scroll at Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's also found in Josephus. I don't know that it's part of the Bible. I don't think so, but it's a historical comment, maybe from that period of time. Of course, the New Revised Standard Version, which is what you have in this section, includes it in the Bible. But I want us to read it for the background. It says in verse 27, but some worthless fellow said, how can this man save us? They despised him and brought him no presents, but he held his peace. Now Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, had been grievously oppressing the Gadites and the Reubenites. Those are the people on the other side of Jordan. He would gouge out the right eye of each of them and would not grant Israel a deliverer. No one was left of Israel across the Jordan whose right eye Nahash, king of the Ammonites, had not gouged out. Now, folks, I'm not sure that this is historical, but I will say this. It makes sense that something was going on that other side of the Jordan, and they had been doing this for a while. And guess what? Most people let it happen. So your children and grandchildren are just going and doing whatever. No problem. Television's on. I got a program to watch tonight. I got to get home. Wow. So it was a city under siege, a city willing to capitulate, possibly part of a larger campaign. Possibly is the key word. An offer that was all against Israel. Oh my goodness. How would you accept this? How could you possibly accept this? But by the way, all during the time of the judges, people accepted stuff like this. Yes? You know Judges 19? Look at me. You know the story. They come and surround the house. We want the man. The man of the house says, no, you can't have him, but you can have my daughter. Really? Eventually, they send out the concubine. Folks, this whole Bible is filled during this period of time with people that remind me of Americans. Their only concern is food, entertainment, more entertainment, and more food, and sleep in between. In your notes, it was an offer to limit Israel's military ability. I don't know what it all means. Some men have said that in the military in those days, when you held a shield, it covered your left side. So if you had your right eye out, you just were unable to fight, because if your left eye was covered and your right eye was blind, you were in hurt. But at the very least, anybody knows if you only have one eye, you have depth perception problems. You couldn't fight very well. The whole point was to limit their ability to fight back against the Ammonites. Secondly, it was an offer to allow continual subservience. I mean, you know, if you eliminate someone's military ability, you know, take away all their guns and, you know, because only criminals have guns, we know that. Take away all their ability to defend themselves. So what do? You allow them to be continually subservient. In your notes, I say this, good for farming and not much else. You could still farm, you could still give them tribute, but you couldn't do much in the line of defending yourself. This was pretty common. Next, it was an offer meant to humiliate, shame, degrade, reproach Israel and Israel's God. Reproach Israel and Israel's God. Yes, a leader rises to the occasion. I want you to look at the last two verses. I'm assuming you know. You don't find in the Bible very many verses repeated twice. So if God has to tell you something twice, Proverbs 22 and verse 3, a prudent man foreseeth the evil, and he rolls over and goes back to sleep. He takes a nap. He eats more. He wonders what's on another channel of television. No, he hideth himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. Friend, everyone look at me. I know we are a small crowd tonight, but we're the crowd that is here. And every person in this room, even you folks, and by the way, I'm going to mention names. Lois has never seen herself as a leader. You've always been the person behind the scenes. That's your problem, because God puts you to lead in certain areas too. You don't have to be the person here. You don't have to be the person in charge of Awana. I'm not mad at you. I like you. Now, Frenchie, that's a different story. Here's the thing, sister, everybody leads. And everybody needs to recognize you lead whether you want to or not. And when you don't want to and you back up and allow other people to lead, then we got problems. A leader rises to the occasion. They do something every time. Number two, a leader responds appropriately. I'm going to ask you a question. We have a leader as a president now, whether we want him or not. And when a crisis happens in America, in Syria, in Ukraine, he lectures like a granny school teacher. I'm going to ask you a question. What do you think Reagan would have been saying? What do you think, I don't like him. What do you think FDR would be saying? Well, they're bad boys. They're really bad, but we're going to put... This is the kind of leadership we have in this country. And it comes from the people that vote for people like this, because they don't recognize that's not leadership. He wants to lecture us on the dangers of being xenophobic and the dangers of not liking people from Syria while they're murdering people in Paris. Yeah, a leader responds appropriately. 1 Samuel 11, verse 4. Then came the messengers to Gibeah of Saul and told the tidings in the ear of the people. And all the people lifted up their voices and wept. And behold, Saul came after the herd out of the field and said, "What aileth the people that they weep?" And they told him the tidings of the men of Jabesh. And the Spirit of God came upon Saul when he heard these things, and his anger was kindled greatly. By the way, the relationship between God's Spirit and the anger is together. I mean, whatever happened here wasn't just Saul. It was God moving him to do something. He says, and he took a yoke of oxen, hewed them in pieces, and sent them throughout all the coast of Israel by the hands of messengers, saying, "Well, if you want to help, well, I'm not sure what to do. May I say this? If you come, ladies, from you over here to you guys, all every woman, if you come from a family where you were abused, you'll never understand me, because I came from a family that the man was in charge. And when there was problems, the man did something. Tragically, we have families where fathers are drunks or worse. All they do is sleep, eat, drink, and other things. And you never grew up around a man that actually thought, the responsibilities of my children were not my wife's, they were mine. That's what a Christian man does. He arises to the occasion, and she also, my wife leads in these areas, responds appropriately. I know women, some women find me, I make them nervous. Because you see a man as being abusive. Ask my daughter how many times I abused her. Actually, I reared her to be bossy too. You say why? I don't think women ought to be little weenies. Because when dad's away, somebody's got to run the family. We continue. He said, "Whosoever cometh not forth after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done unto his oxen." And the fear of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out with one consent. A leader responds appropriately. I want to say this, it's not in your notes. Leaders vary greatly. Some have big personalities, some have large personalities. Some people like to externalize things and be with people. Some people, like me, when I have something, I like to get alone and think through things. Some people are very methodical, that's fine. Some people are quiet, some people talk, some people are loud, some people are soft. Friend, I grew up around a dad that was loud. My mother is soft, but I'm going to tell you something. You push my mother 1/4 inch from where she's at, she doesn't move. She knows who she is, and this is who she is. And I don't understand people that never, ever rise to the occasion. Your kids are going to hell. Your family's a wreck. Where's the nearest couch so I can get a nap? By the way, do you realize when you walk into a room, you intuitively know who the leaders are? Your children do too. In your notes, all leaders, and especially Christian leaders, in your notes, they have a sense of righteous anger or indignation. Righteous anger and indignation. In this room, my call is my polar opposite. We're both old. He's slightly older. He's the nice one. I'm not the nice one. Do you realize old Mike over here? I've seen him. You're in the right spot. This old boy can get, he doesn't explode like me. He probably won't wring your neck. But don't think he's some little weenie. You don't know Mike very well. You see, this is what we don't get. We're all different, but any leader, if something is wrong, immediately that grabs that leader. They will not tolerate stupid. Which means, folks, you have to have a sense of righteous indignation too. Next, I don't know how else to say this. This is my favorite statement in the whole sermon tonight. I'm going to say it this way. They have an immediate sense of no. Or let me say it another way. No, you won't. Or let me say it this way. You will not. And whether they say that externally or whether they just mean that, there's something about a leader that says, no, you won't. Now, if you grew up and you're 50, 60, 70, 80 years old and you've never led and you have a hard time getting out of your chair, I don't know what to say. I go back, I know everybody in this room. Some of you very well. Here's the problem. Some of you have taken a back seat in your own life all your life. It's time to get in the driver's seat of your life. And when action is necessary, you rise and you take appropriate action. And when something stupid happens, you're willing to say, "No, that won't fly," whatever it is. By the way, you might have to do that within a marriage. Hello? Because I've known men married to crazy women and women married to worthless men. And what you find is the woman married to a worthless man will never say, here's the line. You step over that line and that's the end of the story. My mother married an unsaved guy. I think she thought Dad was saved when they got married. He was a decent guy. My dad drank one time. Now, he said till he died he was a drinker. I saw my dad drink two or three beers in my 56 years, okay? He's a heavy drinker. But before I was born, Mom said one night he came home, he drank a few beers with some friends. Now, you understand, my mom had a simple rule. You will not drink. Now, see, some of you, you have no rules. You're in the middle. You're nothing in the center. Mom in front of my dad, which was much louder and meaner than Mom, Mom simply said, if you drink, that's the end of this marriage. Here's the problem. Good women married to weenies never stand. Men married to crazy women never stand. And the children go to hell. You have to be a leader. This doesn't mean you have to be me. Doesn't mean you have to be bossy. It means if there's something you must say, this is the way it is. And may I say this? I could tell stories right in this room about people that have done that. Then I can tell stories where people never do that. There is no line that person can't cross. That person can do anything they want to you. Really? Who are you? Look at me. Who are you at the core? Nobody? I think I need to preach this on Sunday morning. We continue. Next page. A leader determines the course of action. Boy, the moment he found out about this, he's thinking, what am I going to do? The next thing a leader does is get others on his or her side. He gathered the whole nation. He says, you either get here and get on my side, or your oxen are going to look like this oxen. I don't know if he could have pulled this off. Sharon always said, your big weapon is just the threat, really, isn't it? I don't know if Saul could have done this, but they thought he could do it. You get other people on your side. Lastly, you do whatever is necessary. Whatever is necessary. Now, I go back to a story I just told you. Cliff Cavallis. Some of you know old Cliffy. By the way, you'll never meet a nicer guy than Cliffy. He is one of the most truly generous, nice people. He has one of the best outgoing personalities. But I still remember one little incident in this church where he saw his daughter doing something with other kids, and it wasn't even that bad. And you would have thought the world had ended. Where my lieutenant commander friend, his fat, lazy, self-absorbed wife that couldn't get out of bed till noon, he couldn't figure out why the kids couldn't get an education. Because they couldn't get to school. So his solution? Homeschool. So his wife can sleep in later. Because there was something about him, look at me, that could never look at his wife and say, this will not float. You're looking at a person, I don't play games with anybody. I'm a generous person, I'm a pretty nice person, but there's only so far I go down the road with anybody. And by the way, to have a good family and to have a reasonable marriage and to have a reasonable life, you must know who you are. Or you become nothing, your children become a wreck, and you become a casualty, which we've seen so often. There's a bunch of verses in your notes. We're not going to read them. I'll let you read them. I'll tell you what they're about. Please look at me. This is the strangest thing in the Bible. In chapter 10, when Samuel looks at Saul and says, the Spirit of the Lord is going to come upon you. In chapter 10, when the Spirit of the Lord comes upon me, please look at me. It never says Ruach Yahweh. It says Ruach Elohim. Because Yahweh was the personal name of God for people who were believers. Elohim was the generic name. And it, you can read every verse in this in these verses, and this is what you're going to find. Every single believer in the Old Testament, the Ruach Yahweh, the Spirit of the Lord, came upon them, with the exception of two, Saul and Balaam. I believe that God used Saul, and I believe he used Balaam. But it wasn't a personal God that used them. It was the God of the universe, used unsaved people. I'll let you look at that on your own. Number four, a leader rises to the occasion, responds appropriately. Did I say number four? Did I leave number three out? Frenchie. Actually, there is no number three. So there's four is three. You know, when you sit up there with Frenchie, he messes you up every time. Number three, a leader organizes and uses all resources. The first thing he does in chapter 11, verse 8, is he numbers the people. He numbered them. In verse 9, he sends information. He says, and they said unto the messengers that came, thus shall you say unto the men of Jabesh-Gilead, tomorrow by the time the sun is hot, be hot, you shall have help. And the messengers came and showed it to the men of Jabesh, and they were glad. Therefore the men of Jabesh said, tomorrow we will come out unto you, and you shall do with us what seemeth good unto you. And it was so on the morrow that Paul put forth the people in three companies. And they came into the midst of the host in the morning watch. And they slew the Ammonites. That's 2 to 6 a.m. They slew the Ammonites until the heat of the day. I'm not sure when the heat of the day is. I'm going to guess sometime like 1 to 2 to 3 in the afternoon. So they were killing these guys all day. And it came to pass that they which remained were scattered, so that two of them were not left together. Saul does what leaders must do. First of all, he unified the people. They say they come out in verse 7 as one people or one man in Hebrew. Secondly, he ascertained his resources. He counts and figures out what he has to use in verse 8. He numbers people. Next, he communicates his intentions. He tells the people in the city, I'm going to be there, we're going to be there tomorrow, and we're going to rescue you. And lastly, he uses tried and true tactics. He used the kinds of tactics that work. He used surprise. He got there before people woke up. He used the early morning hours before people rose. He split his army into three so he could hit them from three different angles. And as they said, one of my favorite stories in the Civil War, he's a terrible general in the sense that he's on the wrong side of things. But Nathan Bedford Forrest, very much on the wrong side of the war and a racist to the core and beyond, founded a little group called the KKK, just so you know. But there was one thing about him that was well known in the Civil War. He never commanded a big army. He always commanded cavalry. But he had a philosophy that's this. Once you got them on the run, the enemy, you didn't give up. He said that this way, you kept them on the scare. You got them terrified and got them moving backwards. And let me say this. Leaders, do something. Look at me. You find out there's a problem in your home, you start World War III. Because if you don't, what changes? Please tell me. I know. I'm a confrontationalist. I have found if I would have changed one thing in my life, I would have confronted many things as a young man that I did not, because I did not understand. That's all I'm going to say. I have learned that nothing ever gets better without confrontation. Stupid gets worse. Leaders, they utilize and organize all their resources. The fourth point, and it is a beautiful part, and we'll be done with this. A leader credits God and God's servants. To me, this is, if there's one highlight in Saul's life, it's the next passage. We remember back in chapter 10, verse 27. But the children of Belial is a Hebrewism, folks. It actually sons of Belial in Hebrew. And it's a way Hebrew expresses an adjective. worthless people said, "Well, how shall this man save us?" And they despised him and brought him no presents, but he held his peace. In my opinion, these two passages are the highlight of the highlights of Saul's life. And Saul said, "Now the battle's done. There shall not a man be put to death this day, for today the Lord hath wrought salvation in Israel." Even though he could have killed these people, got rid of these people, Saul was generous in this battle. He gave the credit to the Lord. He did nothing to harm the people. And to me, this is the highlight. So here's what happens. Saul has a situation. And when he gets to that situation, he rises to the occasion. He then responds appropriately with anger, and this will not fly, and this will not happen, and we will do something. He gathers and utilizes all the people, and he has a great victory, but at the end of the victory, he doesn't kill those people that were bad-mouthing him. Instead, he gives the glory to God. He says, "No one's going to die," and at the end of the day, it's a beautiful place to end. This is the final place. At the very bottom, and I'll close with this, I did not write these words. Frenchie is of no living value, but he did guess. Anybody else guess who wrote these four statements? There's only one person that has this kind of English. A guy by the name of Winston Churchill. He said, "In war, resolution. In defeat, defiance. In victory, I can't say the word. In peace, goodwill." And may I say this? When the battle was over, Saul was generous. He gave the glory to God. He did nothing to harm his opponents. And this is the high point of Saul's life. I'm going to ask you a question. Please look at me. Do you understand you're a leader? What happens if you have to lead against people in your own family? You better take stock. Ladies, if you're married to a worthless male, you're going to allow him to continue to be worthless. Guys, you're married to a woman that will not do right, you're going to allow her to affect your children. You have a broader family. It comes to a place where here it is. "Here I stand. I can do no other." That's what a leader says. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word tonight.